Hey, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the No Way Podcast. You're probably wondering, why did he just sing that? What is he doing? That was terrible. Well, it's in honor of our special guest this week, Laura Osnes. Laura is a two-time Tony Award nominee, best known for her work on the Broadway stage. She has played starring roles in Grease as Sandy, Bonnie in Bonnie and Clyde, and Cinderella in Cinderella. Yes, she is a real Disney princess. On the Hallmark Network, she's led One Royal Holiday, A Homecoming for the Holidays, and In the Key of Love. Look out for Laura in the upcoming Disney Princess The Concert this November, and she's currently filming as the lead in another Hallmark feature, so please follow her at Laura Osnes on Twitter and Instagram for updates on that project as well. Okay, this is a big episode. Let's go to the movies. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the No Way Podcast. I am so excited that you're here and taking the time do this. Thank you. It is so good to see you. I haven't seen you or caught up since, which brings us to how we met, which is on the set of Homecoming for the Holidays, a Hallmark movie that we filmed just under two years ago now.
Yeah.
And that was such a good time. That was so much fun to film out here. And I'll speak for myself in that I don't even think you were aware at the time how much fanboying I was doing during that whole process. And I had known you through YouTube videos. I watched you as a teenager perform. I've known about your career just because you're, you know, the Laura Osnes from so many shows. So I don't know if you were aware at the time. Like, I think I was being pretty cool about it the whole time.
You were so cool, but it was also kind of lovely to come to Canada and be like, someone knows who I am. Like, thank you. It was really, really sweet. And I know you're quite the talented performer yourself. And that was just cool to connect on a musical theater level, because not everybody does, especially in the Hallmark world. So I appreciated it. And thank you.
There's two more fanboys here who'd like to meet you. Markian's taking up all your focus. I'm Kayvon.
I'm flattered. Hi, Kayvon.
I'm going to be honest here. I'm going to play a little bit devil's advocate. I'm actually a really big fan of Markian.
I mean, I am
too.
Really
exciting to get to work with him regularly.
Right.
It is very nice to meet you, Laura.
Thank you, guys. I'm really so honored to be here.
I just wanted to touch on, because I think it's so fucking cool that you just came off the Kennedy Honors for Dick Van Dyke. That is, number one, Dick Van Dyke, he's like a living legend. I see
legend.
Him walking and he's like, he is very old at this point, but he is
95
years young, baby.
Do you want to talk, just quickly touch on what that experience was like? You sang,
thank
you, you danced, you hosted a little bit. Tell us a little bit just about that.
Gosh, thank you for bringing that up. I was so honored to get to be a part of it. I've actually been on the artist committee for the Kennedy Center Honors for the last like 10 years. So this is my third time getting to perform. And I attend every year. And it was so cool this year because it was a combination of outside and pre-recorded and stuff because of COVID. They couldn't do it the way they normally did. And I was so honored to get to be asked to celebrate Dick Van Dyke. I got to dance with Derek Hough, who is an insane, I mean, he's won Dancing with the Stars like multiple times. He's an insane dancer. And I was like, just trying to keep up, but he was so kind and so wonderful and patient and like great with me. And then I got to sing Jolly Holiday directly to Dick Van Dyke. Like, he was sitting 15 feet away and I was like, it's a Jolly Holiday with you, Bert, like directly to Dick. And his face, he was just beaming. And it was just super special. I was pinching myself all week, just so honored and grateful to get to be a part of that really, really cool event. So thank you for bringing that up.
Let's get into it. Laura, what movie have you brought us today?
I have brought to you The Sandlot. Forever. Forever. Brilliant. I grew up watching this movie. I have an older brother, and my parents were divorced, are divorced. So there were times I was just with my dad and my brother, and we had to find movies that the boys liked and I also liked, and this was a staple. I've seen it so many times, and so many of the lines from the movie became part of our like everyday vernacular. And it was cool to revisit. I recently rewatched it also in preparation for this, and it was very cool to see it as a grown up again.
Forever.
Do you remember the first time that you saw it? Do you have a memory attached to kind of like the first time as a kid watching this movie?
Know if I specifically do like the first time. I think my initial reaction was like, ew, baseball movie, because I was into like Disney princesses. But I think this was one baseball movie that I loved. And I totally fell in love with it. It didn't feel like it was like just for guys, even though I don't think there's maybe the mom is the only female in the whole movie.
Wendy Peppercorn.
True.
Well, of course, Wendy. It's Peffer. It's Peffer with an F.
Oh, it's Peffer.
Right? Peffercorn.
Wendy Peppercorn.
Maybe I'm just...
I've been saying Peppercorn my whole life. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess Wendy Peppercorn, too. I always looked up to her.
I don't know if you've noticed my little nod here. I'm trying to be Squints right now. Pretty hard. I got the hat, the glasses, I got my ball and glove.
The kid is a... L7 Weenie.
Yes.
I love this movie so deeply. You don't understand. I'm actually here to fight all of you on these no ways. Sandlot is a perfect movie. There is nothing.
Right?
I'm going to be a terrible host on this episode. I love this movie so deeply in my core. I just, yes, thank you for, I've watched it twice in 48 hours in the last 40. I just love it.
Yes.
Kids a square.
The Sandlot was released April 7th, 1993. It runs for 101 minutes. It was written by David Mickey Evans and Robert Gunter. It is directed by David Mickey Evans as well, who is known for the movie Radio Flyer. It was released by 20th Century Fox on an estimated budget of $7 million, and it did $34 million worldwide, so a modest theatrical release that it had. This movie also came out in an interesting era where Rookie of the Year, Field of Dreams, League of Their Own, and Sandlot came out within like a 2-year span. So I think in the 90s, we were going through this like baseball nostalgia. It stars, I'm going to run through the list here because I think they're all worth mentioning because they're also great, the kids here. Tom Geary as Scotty Smalls, Mike Vitar as Rodriguez, Patrick Renna as Ham Porter, Chauncey Leopardi as Squints, Marty York as Yaya, Brandon Quinton Adams as Kenny DeNunez, Grant Gelt as Bertram Grover Weeks, Shane Obedzinski as Tommy Repeat Timmons, Victor DeMaria as Timmy Timmons, Dennis Leary as Bill, Karen Allen as Mom, and James Earl Jones as Mr. Myrtle.
You in trouble, aren't you, son?
Scotty Smalls moves to a new neighborhood with his mom and stepdad and wants to learn how to play baseball. He eventually meets a ragtag group of local neighborhood boys. Rodriguez, the leader and baseball guru, takes Smalls under his wing and he soon becomes part of the gang. Beyond the fence at the back of the sandlot menaces a legendary ball-eating dog called the Beast, and the kids inevitably must come face to face with this monster.
The Beast!
Fun facts. I think this is something really, really sweet. I just kind of went through the IMDb facts, and writer-director David Mickey Evans stated that all the child actors had such a wonderful summer working on the film to the point that they all considered it the greatest summer of their lives.
I was really curious about that watching it. I was like, was this a positive or negative experience for these kid actors? I was really, because I could see it going really hard one way or the other, because there's a lot of traumatic stories of kid actors and the experiences and the toll on them on sets at that age. But I'm really excited to hear that it was the positive, that it was a good experience.
But that I think that like it, that it was the best summer of their lives is totally reflected. We can tell as a viewer watching this movie that these kids are genuinely having such a good time. And it just comes across on screen.
And it's a theme of the movie too. The narrator, the grown up Smalls says that.
It was in the greatest summer of my life.
Sandlot has 63% on the tomato meter, which is super low. What?
That's ridiculous. Who could not like this movie?
I don't know.
Oh my God.
I was
God.
Shocked. But Roger Ebert gave it 3 stars, and he said this about it, which I think is really, really apt. If you have ever been lucky enough to see A Christmas Story, you will understand what I mean when I say The Sandlot is a summertime version of the same vision. Both movies are about gawky, young adolescents trapped in a world they never made and doing their best to fit in while beset with the most amazing vicissitudes.
Don't be a goofus. Don't be a goofus.
So, Laura, we've come to the part of the podcast where we do the elevator pitch, where we let our guest pitch us, if you were to make this movie and direct it and want to find $7 million for it, really try to capture the essence and the heart of the movie that you're going to try to make, which is called The Sandlot.
Oh my gosh, so much pressure. I just think, well, you guys are Canadian, so I would spiel in the great American pastime of baseball and every kid, boy or girl, their connection to this pastime and this sport, and the perfect summer that this mixed match group of kids had and how their relationships with each other and the obstacle they have to overcome bonds them together for life.
When I get us all into the biggest pickle any of us had ever seen.
Sold.
Sold.
8 million. 9 million.
9 million. Bring
Nine
it.
Million
and you. There's dogs and kids involved. Like, how can you just, it's like a yes. It's going to be popular.
We were all walking on air that night.
I have a question for Laura. Do you like baseball?
You know, as the little sister to a brother who played baseball, I did grow up going to a lot of games, and my dad hosted. My dad would coach. And so I spent a lot of time being a cheerleader on the bleachers. And I did go to some Twins games as a Minnesota girl. So I think baseball, if there was a sport that I knew like the rules of as a kid and like how to play, it was baseball.
And there's a cultural thing, like, because you're American, we're 3 Canadians, but there's a cultural marriage to baseball and the States. Is that something that's true as we perceive it?
Yes, I think so. And definitely like summers were the time for baseball. It was like the spring and summer were the season. I happen to be home in Minnesota this week. I'm filming for Minnesota, and my brother now has 3 boys of his own who all have baseball games this weekend that I'm going to go to. So that's pretty cool. It's kind of a full circle thing.
Could you, like you said, teach me to play catch?
Yeah.
So the givens for The Sandlot, these are the things that we accept as a part of the world and will not factor into our no ways. The first one is baseball skills. Very specifically with the Jet Rodriguez, that kid does some pretty remarkable things, knocking the stitches out of a ball, being able to hit a ball directly into a stationary glove in the outfield. Unreal. So we're just going to accept that. And, you know, he ended up on the Dodgers, so he was working with some potential. The technology. We're not going to pull the technology apart. The Erector set, war machines, the vacuum, tractor beam, all that stuff. And finally, anything that kind of relates to the beast. The idea that the beast can curve and tear the metal apart, the size of the beast that we kind of see in the early stages. We're sort of accepting that. We're getting that through the lens and memory of a child. And so we're not going to pull that apart. Those are things that we accept as The Sandlot's world.
Okay, that's good to know. I thought the beast might come into question.
Is there any givens or anything that we didn't mention that you think should also factor into the argument as a given?
Wow, that's a good point. Well, I was... also knowing that this is a perfect movie. Even my family even said that when we watched it again last night, like all four of us, my parents and my husband, and we were all like, it's perfect. It holds up. They were like, well, what are you going to say that would be a no way for that? Like, we were all trying to brainstorm things that like, would it be possible? And the thing that came to my mind was the beast actually, where I was like, you know, it's bigger at first in reality. And then when you finally see it, you're like, oh, that dog is just a normal, whatever that great breed of dog is.
Bull Mastiff.
Where it's like, you know, it starts the shadow so big and the paw is so big, but you're right. It's through the eyes of a child. That was any kid's worst nightmare was that beast. which is what we all did as kids, was envision the boogeyman is always far more treacherous than he actually turns out to be, if he exists at all. Let's see. Are there any other givens? I don't know. Tobacco makes you throw up.
It's plug. What? Chewing tobacco?
Backy, man.
So I think that does it for our intro here. Now we get to go into the no ways, and you get to see what we've come up with after watching this movie and being like, this is a perfect film. What possibly could we bring to the table?
Okay, play some ball.
Round one.
All right, so I'm going to take lead on the first No Way, which, as I've stated, this is the perfect movie. I look forward to failing. The first No Way is going to come in at 39 minutes into the film The Sandlot. The scene we're about to watch is the legendary moment that Squints fakes drowning to be able to get close to Wendy Peppercorn. It's a questionable scene in time, as time has passed. As a kid, I didn't question it, but it's a pretty questionable move, and luckily the narrator does call it pretty awful. But we're going to watch that scene, and then I'll explain my no way after.
This magic moment.
So little pervert! Oh man, he's a deep shit.
Oh, no way that whoever is right after that, like all of their towels get thrown at them and like their shoes. And I'm like, is that the no way?
What?
This magic moment.
My no way is there's no way that their stuff and their towels would be found that quickly and tossed out the side door for them in that timeline. That's my no way.
Laura, you're so on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember seeing that yesterday going like, how did that happen? Usually you have to, you know, you have to, it's like the coat check where you have to wait in line, you have to go, and then they go get your coat and they latch it to the thing and it always takes forever. And it's like, no, it's just like, oh, all of those boys came together and here's all their stuff getting thrown out. I would agree with that, no way.
Michael Squints Polydorus walked a little taller that day.
From the time it took to go around the building, there's just this arm tossing exactly what they need for them. And they know it's there. They go right there. Anyways, yeah. So, okay, interesting. So you're just a full agreement on that, no way?
I think so, because I remember watching last night and being like, oh, that wouldn't have happened.
Okay, let's walk through it just so we can try to confirm here. The series of events of this happens. He kisses her. She screams, starts to kick him out. So then we've got about 15 seconds. Who do we think is throwing those clothes out? Who is in that locker room and whose arm? And like, who are they? Do they work at the pool? Do they know these boys? Like, do they know their stuff and their clothes automatically because maybe they're repeat offenders? And it's just like, those damn kids did it again. Get their stuff, throw it out. I'm just trying to find a way on this one in how we get from A to B.
I think you're bang on it right now, man. I think there's two other lifeguards that we hear about. I believe they're both guys. I think that they probably have a thing for Wendy Peppercorn. I think that they see this happen. They know these boys have caused shit before. I always forget his name, but the freckled kid, he does his cannonball. He annoys everyone at the pool regularly. This is not the first time they've been kicked out in my mind. Now, time is tricky. It's very quick. But I think that they know these kids' outfits. They know their clothes. And when this happens, they're like, get those fucking kids out of here. They're like, we know where their stuff is. Like, it's not the first time. Get that stupid shirt. He always wears. His shoes are there. Boom. We know your stuff.
Because you're saying to me that Squints makes his awful move on Wendy. She grabs him, is like, the fuck out of here. And one of the lifeguards, we do know it's an adult because the height of the arm over the kid's head. So we know it's an adult or a really tall kid.
There's some tall kids.
Yeah.
It's not another kid lifeguarding Kayvon. It's an older teenager. They don't have an 8-year-old lifeguarding 8-year-old.
Let's agree it's an adult. Can we agree it's an adult?
Yes.
Mike, give that.
Okay. I would say it's an adult.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're saying to me that she goes, pervert, grabs him, they're marching him out, and some adult who works there immediately was like, where are their things? Where are their things?
I don't even think he said, where are those things? I think he knew.
How?
And I also think that these kids, do these kids fold up their clothes when they get home after a day of baseball? There is a pile of their shit in that locker room. One pile of all their stuff. It's like doing laundry for like a kid. You bundle it all up in your arm.
How does he know that that pile is their pile? Because it's a busy day at the pool.
Because they're always stirring shit up at that pool.
It does say that he's, you know, there's that narrator moment where it's like, whenever they weren't playing baseball, they would play 24/7. But the one activity that Benny the Jet Rodriguez would allow them to do if it wasn't baseball was go to the pool.
Going to the pool was what he tolerated best.
So I think they are regulars there. I don't know if they get kicked out all the time because he was like, we were banned from the pool forever that day, you know, where it's like they weren't ever allowed to go back. This was the worst. Maybe they've been banned before, at least kicked out for the day, you know, based on the cannonballs or whatever else was happening. But I do understand the point where they go there enough where, and they always come together and they always leave together. I think they're a band mm-hmm. of brothers. And so maybe it's not like each kid's separate stuff or maybe all of their collective stuff was kept together.
It's the timing that is tricky.
The physics are impossible.
It's the physics of it.
Someone would have to have sprinted in that exact moment.
This guy, this other lifeguard, is in love with Wendy Peppercorn. He sees this go down. And he's like, they're out of here.
But okay, so say,
are any of us lifeguards?
No. I have a bronze cross in swimming.
Of course you do.
I've got a bronze cross. I was maybe going to be a lifeguard.
Really?
I kind of dipped my toe into that pool.
That would suit you. I could see you being a lifeguard.
Yeah. Well, my sister was a lifeguard. She legit worked as a lifeguard. So anything my sister did that like was impressive, I had to do and be better at it. So
did she ever have a situation like this go down? Did she have a squint try to...
No. She had some kids at the YMCA get into some sticky situations, but saved them.
I'm going to reshow you this clip, and I'm going to show you the other lifeguard on duty, and let's track what they're doing.
Can I point out one other thing before we... When he comes out of the water, he is clutching his glasses.
So one of my original no ways was there's no way she even gives him mouth-to-mouth because, like, he's clearly conscious.
Right.
He's holding his glasses.
He's kind of already grinning.
I know, he is.
Hey, they end up getting married, right?
Exactly.
So here we're going to watch this clip again, and we're going to look at the other lifeguard and what they're doing.
Oh, man, he's a deep shit.
So see, over the shoulder, walking slow.
There's one of them.
Yeah.
Like this guy with the hat back there?
Just walking.
Yeah, he's casually
following along. I didn't see anybody... Just look it to a dressing room.
There's no sense of urgency behind these lifeguards to get their clothes out of there.
No. Maybe there could be a sole worker that mans the locker room, though, and protects everybody's stuff.
But someone would have to communicate to that person. Hey, right. Get those baseball kids
Roger, piled. Roger.
I would like to make my vote.
Yeah. I love how specific this no way is.
I love how specific it is, and yet Laura still called it.
Yeah.
that's never happened. That's crazy.
Which means maybe it's a bigger no way than we thought, you know?
Maybe.
So I've made my case. My no way was the clothes, and I followed it up with showing that the only other representative of the pool in that clip was evidently not in a hurry and did not seem to be moving quickly to find their things or communicating to somebody to find their things. So I'll let it stand there.
I'm going to go no way. Because I know we've talked about how much we love this movie and it's perfect. This one, we just couldn't kind of explain away. The physics of it don't make any sense. I'm staying no way on it.
Yeah, I really want it to be a way. But I think it's a no way after seeing how casual that lifeguard in the bucket hat was. So he's in no hurry.
Did it ruin the movie for me? Absolutely not. Did I think of it for 3 seconds beyond it happening? Absolutely not. So in the grand scheme of things, still a perfect movie, but that is a no way moment.
No way.
I am so angry at all of you for dropping the ball on that. You know, I felt like the lawyer in Miracle on 34th Street. Like I didn't want to win. I wanted it to be okay. I didn't want to put Santa away, but I did my job.
You did your job.
All right, so that's the first one down. Sandlot's lost the first round. It is a no way, but it's a beautiful movie, and it is a very minuscule problem. It does not affect my enjoyment of this film at all.
No way.
They get a little more interesting from this point forward, but there it is. That's round one.
Round two, Mike Gill.
Round two.
So the next No Way, we're going to jump ahead a little bit in the story here. So we're going to watch a scene taking place at 55 minutes and 20 seconds here, in which the gang is playing baseball at the Sandlot, and Benny is going to knock the stitches off a ball, and then the following we'll discuss after.
Anybody got any money?
No.
Then it ain't okay, because now we can't play no more.
Yeah, we can.
What? You got 98 extra cents lying around at home, Smalls?
No, but I got a ball.
Okay, it's pretty clear from that clip what the No Way is, and it's an interesting one because it kind of is the catalyst of the whole film, this No Way. And so my No Way is there's no way that Smalls would take his stepfather's Babe Ruth signed ball to play with at all. We see clearly earlier in the film that there is another ball he's playing with his stepfather. We also see it's quite like it's a tough relationship between him and his stepfather, at least at the start. He definitely doesn't want to get in his bad side. He's definitely trying to build a stronger relationship with him. I don't think he'd take a ball that, even though he doesn't know who Babe Ruth is, he clearly knows this ball is very important to his stepfather. And I think there's another ball in the house. They've played with another ball. So my No Way is that he'd take the Babe Ruth ball at all.
Oh, yeah, the Great Bambino. Of course. I thought you said the Great Bambi.
That's a very good point. I never thought about the fact that there would be another ball in the house somewhere. You're right. There clearly would be.
Well, they played with one. So the
they
dad
did.
And him had catch and played catch with a baseball. So there is another one in that house.
I think Smalls wants to be the hero in that moment and be like, I have a ball. It's okay. I think his want to fill the void on behalf of the team is greater than his dad is out of town. He even says later, he's like, I was going to bring it back. He doesn't know who Babe Ruth is. He knows, yeah, it's probably special, but like, you know, maybe it was given to him, but like, we're just going to play for the afternoon and I'll bring it back.
It's an interesting one. Cause yeah, like I like what you said for sure about the fact, like he wants to be the hero in that moment. Like, I mean, there's definitely things I've thought about to justify this in my own head. I just lean a little bit towards the side where I'm like, he's played catch with his dad another ball. You meant like when it does get knocked into the backyard of the beast, he does say, he's like, no, I need that ball back, guys. Like, it's important to my stepdad. It's signed by some lady.
You're right.
Some lady named Ruth. Baby Ruth.
He does know it's very important, that ball, even without knowing who Babe Ruth is. I just remember growing up, like, my dad had built this, like, pirate ship in the basement, this, like, model that he'd built for, like, 15 years. And I didn't know the fucking importance of it or, like, what the origin of or any of that stuff. All I knew is, I don't touch it. Do not touch the ship, you know?
Yeah, this one's tricky for me because of what you just mentioned, Mike, there, of his reaction when it goes into the backyard is he starts crying, like, immediately because he knows in his heart of hearts how important that ball is to his dad. And he also knows, and we all know by seeing it, that his dad is pretty strict, pretty cold, and would be really mad. So if I'm trying to justify this, like you said, Laura, it's like, it's the heat of the moment. He wants to be the hero. He wants to impress his friends. But then I go back to, there has to be another ball in the house because he played with one, you know, 45 minutes earlier in the movie with his dad. So if I'm him and my, you know, I wanted to impress my friends too. I wanted to always be the hero. I would say I have a ball. I would come home. I'd be like, okay, I've got a choice here. I can either take my dad's lady ball signed or I can go to the garage and maybe get
lady ball.
The signed lady ball.
Signed lady yeah. ball.
Every stepdad has a lady ball.
If I've got a choice of those, I would always go, especially if the threat of my father is looming over me, I'm going to go for the ball sitting in the garage. And we've also established that they've hit balls into that backyard already in this movie. So he knows the danger and he's witnessed that home runs happen with these boys. And that if I were to take this, the risk is absolutely there if I'm going to be using that ball.
It's a way. It's clearly a way. There's nothing
okay,
wrong with this moment. I'm going to speak as an unpopular child with very few friends. The need
for... Wait, is this you or is this a character you're about to...
No, this is me.
Oh, okay, great. I just really wanted to clarify that.
I'm speaking from the perspective of a kid who had a hard time making friends, and it's like the need for belonging and the fragility of friendship in that position is encompassing. It takes you over. You do not think clearly. I think this kid has shown that he has a really hard time making friends. He's gone through, his dad has died. He really needs affirmation. He needs a community. He needs a group. Mom's aggressively in this movie being like, you need to make friends. Like, she's at the point where she's like having an intervention with him about friendship. It's really, I don't know if that's great parenting in that moment, but we know this kid has a hard time with friends, and he really shits the bed the first time he tries. Thank God Benny the Jet's a good person. But I also would believe that even though we're an hour into the film and he's a part of the game, I know that as a kid who has a hard time making friends, you don't trust it. It's still always like you think you're going to lose that foundation. You're going to lose that group. So I think when he sees that they've lost the ball, his instinct is, I don't want this game to end. I don't want this friendship to end. So he needs to find a way to let them keep playing. I think that there's a possibility. Yeah, maybe there was another ball, but maybe he couldn't find it and he didn't. The time's ticking and he's scared. They're going to be gone when I come back and they'll never let me into the group again. So he goes for the thing that he knows where it is. And I'll also add on, I know that this is you do poor decision making when you're trying to make friends. When I was a kid, there was a boy who was really mean to me and I really wanted him to be my friend. And I gave him all of my original Star Wars toys. And I knew that they were valuable. And I knew that they were, and I loved them. I had the Millennium Falcon.
And I'm never giving you those back, Kayvon.
But do you like me now?
You're okay.
You eat dog crap for breakfast, geek.
Part of me wonders if Smalls was debating the whole run back, whether he tells them, I got a ball, guys, I got a ball. And look, I think it's a special one. Like, was he almost proud that it was like a special ball? Or then at the last minute, did he decide like, oh, well, then if they know it's special, like we should just be normal and I should downplay it so that nothing happens to it. Like, I wonder if he debated about telling them or if he just didn't know any better, didn't care. I also wanted to equate it to the fact of like a little girl, like borrowing mom's jewelry. Like, is there any excitement? Smalls isn't a very rebellious kid. Like he's pretty straight laced, but is there any excitement in going, dad's not here, or like, I can borrow mom's jewelry and feel pretty, or taking the car out and getting in a car crash or something and being like, oh no, my parents are going to kill me. But like, you never think it's going to happen. You always think you're going to make it back home. It's fine. I just need to borrow the car for a minute. I'm going to come back.
Actually, there's something really interesting in that about like the idea of like borrowing mom's jewelry. In terms of like a quality perspective, where like he's already had the situation where he had a baseball glove that was like a crappy plastic one and he got given a better one and he learned like, oh, there's different qualities of these things. Like, I was supposed to be playing with a good baseball glove. So there's almost a layer maybe where he goes home and he goes, well, I don't know if that ball I play with is my dad is like a baseball the way like these guys need. I bet that one in my dad's office, though, that's for sure like a real baseball. And I know I'm not going to show up with some fake or some off-brand baseball. I'm going to make sure I bring the same kind that we've been playing with.
I just don't think it's about the ball. I don't think it's about the ball because he doesn't mention that it's good or bad or whatever. And if you think about the tone when he runs back.
I got it, guys!
He's a lunatic.
I got it! I got the ball, guys! I got it!
He's screaming from the edge of the sand lot. I'm like, I got a fucking ball! I got it!
Right here, guys! Got the ball! I got it!
He's wired up, and I think the source of it is he's so scared he's going to lose these friends. And he sees that getting the game back on track is how he retains this group. And he's not stable. He's not thinking clearly. And then it hits home when the ball
goes over
the
fence. Yeah, what's the shortest
route?
Yeah.
You're ready. I got it.
I would say the urgency in which he runs home and because yes, the kids, when he says, I have a ball, he thinks obviously of his dad's because that's front of mind that there's one sitting on a mantle and they yell at him to go get that ball. They go get it.
Go get it. Yeah.
Well, here we are. I'm away. I'm away on it. I think with the sense of urgency and the lack of thinking this through, which happened to me all the time as a kid, I think there's a way on this one.
I think it's a real dumb move, but he's not a popular kid and he's got a really cool group of friends now. And his fear of losing it is driving that decision. Total way.
I'm trying not to be swayed by you guys. I do kind of like to be swayed, but I think with the stakes of the, my mentality behind it is that the stakes of the movie require him to take that ball and I buy it. I never once questioned it. I never thought that there would be another ball in the house and he doesn't know who Babe Ruth is. So he's a kid in that moment wanting to keep his friends. And I'm glad you brought it up, but I say way.
Life finds a way.
You know, like I'll, if I can even throw to my own no way here, it's like the story I said before about like that ship that my dad built that I knew don't touch. Yeah, I fucking broke that ship at one point in my childhood. Like 100% I did. Wait. I hit it with a giant bouncy workout ball once. And I was like, oh no. So it's like, yeah, you can know things are precious as a kid and still be able to compartmentalize that somewhere else because the urgency of whatever you're doing is way more important.
Even if that ball hadn't gotten knocked over the fence, stepdad would have known. Like, you hit a ball with a bat
so
once,
scuffed.
You know something. And if it's, like, on a mantle, he's going to be like, is this got a nick? Like, he would know immediately.
Right.
Yeah. It's such a bonehead plan. Yeah.
But I think Smalls is clearly so clueless. He's so, unfortunately, clueless that he doesn't know better. Anyway, his friends are more important in that moment. You're right.
It's beautiful. His friends are more important than a Babe Ruth signed ball. It's lovely. It's the message of the movie again, guys. It's a perfect movie. It's totally away.
It is a total away. And it's a great metaphor. What's more important? Kids keeping the game going or some relic of about an old player signed a ball? It's keeping the game going.
Bitchin', your ball, your ups.
I have to say, this is really joy-giving for me. it's just so cool to like... to really break down a movie that is so beloved that I love. I'm thrilled that you guys love it too. I've never had an hour-long conversation about the movie Sandlot before, and I think it's high time that this happened. So thank you for providing the platform for us to do so.
You said you watched it with your family, and I'm kind of excited to hear maybe the discussion in the future between you and your family members about these no ways. I feel like they're going to have opinions on it if they're as passionate as you.
Oh, they will. And I'm going to bring it back to them after this whole conversation is over. I'm going to make them watch the episode. And I think they will also have thoughts. Can't wait to hear them.
I also love, Laura, that you watched this with your entire family last night. That is so sweet. I wish I could be, you know, I live in Vancouver, my parents are in Winnipeg, and obviously you're visiting, so this is all kismet and works out well to, you know, but there is something of like Blockbuster Friday nights for me, going, standing in line for like half an hour, hoping my movie's there, coming home, sitting on a couch with my mom, my dad, my sister, was the best feeling in the world. And I am like constantly trying to chase that high ever since, yeah. I think.
Why were you in line for a half hour? Where were you?
Dude, did
you,
Friday night? I worked at a Rogers Video. That place was the hypest spot in town on Friday and Saturday.
There was
night.
A line around the entire store.
Wow.
The entire store. There was a square lineup of Blockbuster.
Laura, when you went to rent movies, did you feel that the people who worked at the movie stores, that it was kind of a cool job?
Your fishing line's kind of showing there, Mike.
Do you remember thinking, like, that must be pretty cool, the guys who work at the movie rental store?
Mike, I'm going to be honest and say no.
No.
But
way.
It's nothing against you. You turned out okay. Weenie.
We have a tie going, and
I love it.
I love when we have ties. This is the bottom of the ninth. We're coming around third. Here we are, ladies and gentlemen.
Base is loaded.
Round three.
My no way, it's a two-parter here. So first part of this no way comes in at 29 minutes, where Squints is going to tell a legend of this man called Mr. Myrtle. So we're about to be introduced to the legend of Mr. Myrtle and his dog, which is known as the Beast. All right, we're going to be introduced that he's this murderous junkyard owner.
My grandpa, Squigman Palidores, was police chief back then. When he ordered Mr. Myrtle to turn his backyard into a fortress and chain up the Beast and put him under the house where he could never get out to eat children and stuff.
And then we're going to skip ahead and go to the hour 30 mark where we meet the man himself.
You knew Babe Ruth?
George? I sure did. And he knew me. He was almost as great a hitter as I was. I would have broken his record too, but...
You went blind.
Yep.
We just got introduced to Mr. Myrtle, clearly one of the nicest people ever in the world. This guy gives a baseball to them in trade to save his butt.
You guys come by here once a week and talk baseball with me. We'll call it an even trade.
All right, so my no way is that the legend that we watched about the junkyard, the legend of Mr. Myrtle, aligns with the character we see on screen, and there is no way, that's my no way, is that the legend doesn't align with who we see. I don't understand how these kids got this legend, where this legend came from. There's usually like a genesis or an origin of like a child's legend story. There's some truth to it, but over the years, the facts have been changed or altered. To me, there's just no way that that legend would be connected to this man. And then he's a famous baseball player. There's no way that they would not know him and that he's living in their neighborhood. Okay, that's it.
That's good.
What do you think about that?
I'm realizing for the first time, again, I always chalked it up to, you know, the vision that the kids create, that he obviously looks very different in that dream story sequence than in real life. And he, Squints, heard this legend from his, great uncle, whoever, Palidomus, whatever his name was. So the legend has been passed down from a relative of Squints's, an uncle or a grandpa or something. And so it is interesting. I would believe that they would be different people. The fact that he's a baseball legend and they don't know it. But I think they've just been too afraid to ever even go over there because A, the Beast is a menace and they've heard that Mr. Myrtle is a menace. And so no one's ever even dared to knock on the front door because that's what Squints was told. And I wonder, Mr. Myrtle must be kind of to himself. Like, you know, at the end, he makes a deal with the guys. Hey, come over and talk baseball with me once a week, because I think blind Mr. Myrtle, baseball player, can't probably live the life he used to live and probably is a little bit of a hermit and doesn't go out about town much and stays in. And so maybe they just never saw him and no one knew.
Like, how much of a hermit are we talking? Because even if Mr. Myrtle went out into the community for, say, groceries or, you know, his basics, at least he needs to do that, wouldn't the town people know he's like, oh, there's that blind sweet guy? You know what I mean? And that he would be kind of known of, like, I'm trying to take this back to like legends that I had of old crotchety men growing up. And there was actually, we had a sandlot in my backyard. I'm in my backyard, in my playground's backyard of R.F. Morrison in Winnipeg. We had a sandlot fence with the green slats. This guy put it out and he actually added barbed wire on the top of his fence. And it was known that if your ball went in there, you're not getting it back.
Then how do we get the ball back?
We don't. It's history. Kiss it goodbye. Kiss it.
Shut up, Tommy.
Because there has been attempts to go do so from this old man who purposely doesn't give you your balls back just because he's upset that he is like on an elementary school playground. And that years of stuff getting chucked over into his fence, he's fed up with it. And so that was known. And like, so there was truth to that of like, there is this actually old mean man there. This guy, if he's going out into like the regular life, he's so nice. And so how
did you ever meet the guy though on the other side of the fence? Did you, Markian, ever go knock on his door and ever meet him in real life?
Great question.
Good question. Good challenge.
It was legend, Laura. It was legend.
Never asked. Maybe he was a nice guy.
He might have been nice.
Shoot.
It was his grandpa, right? It was Squints. My grandpa.
For so long, I was like, oh yeah. The kids made this story up. But you're right. It's like Squints's family.
Yeah, that's the guy with the glasses saying forever. It's like
oh my God, that's right. See, that's so great. It's like I knew that. And then it's like I kind of forgot about that till just now.
That's Squints's grandpa or dad. Or he says it. He's like, my great grandpa, whoever. But then at the beginning, he was like, 20 years ago.
It all started about 20 years ago.
You know what I mean? So like they made
my great grandpa from 20 years ago.
Yeah. And then too, like it's the 120, 173 guys, you know, it's like, that's where the legend comes in. And through the kids' eyes that it's like, it's basically like this. And who knows, Squints probably, he might be exaggerating a little bit for the sake of Smalls. He's on the stage right there. I mean, he's putting on a show in telling the story.
The legend of the Beast goes back a long time.
So you talk about the legend of his being a legendary baseball player in the community, not knowing who he was. An interesting thing to point out is like Jackie Robinson didn't play till 1947. So this guy would have been a kind of still on the fringe. Like he wouldn't have been profiled or put in the spotlight, you know, again, because we have to acknowledge like the racial inequality of the time he would have played. So it doesn't surprise me that people wouldn't know him or remember him. And the history we have of forgotten black athletes and black figures in time is undeniable. So I don't, that doesn't throw me off actually. And then on top of that, his career was stolen from him by an injury causing blindness. And I think about you talking about him, he's so nice, but we don't know what he was like 30 years ago when the injury happened. He could have been a very angry person when he first moved into that house, not wanting to see people, not wanting to talk about baseball, dealing with the bitterness of having been robbed of what was already probably a hard thing for him to do, play baseball as a black man in the 20s. So I think that there might be a genesis of that he was kind of angry for a little while and didn't want people around. But we're meeting this guy later. He's been listening to baseball through his house, through the fence for years and years and years. And a door opens, somebody knocks, and he takes the moment, he seizes it, and he tries to engage.
Come on in.
So I think it's a way.
Yeah, I mean, on my end, like, it's interesting because I think that the storytelling aspect of, like, sharing a legend with the rest of the kids makes total sense from a kid's perspective and everything like that. Also, for me, first of all, I totally agree with every point Kayvon made as a way to justify why this legend could exist.
Good point.
But also, for me, the legend isn't so much about Mr. Myrtle. Mr. Myrtle is a plus one to the legend of the Beast.
Mm. And he grew mean so that he could protect the junkyard with only one thing on his mind. To kill everyone that broke in. And he did.
And so for me, it's like the dog is kind of the legend. And no matter how you look at it, that dog exists. And even though it's not a giant beast dog the way they imagine it, or the way we see it earlier on in the movie, it is still a big fucking dog. I mean, the little boy says it himself. A doggy. Ooh, a big doggy.
Ooh, a big doggy.
It's a big doggy. And these kids are like size and scale is crazy right. When you're a kid.
Yeah.
Like I remember being in grade 4 and seeing grade 8s and I was like, those are adults. And so it's like a giant dog to however old these kids are probably does feel huge. And so the legend becomes, okay, we have this fact that there's this crazy legend about this dog. Well, who's the owner then? Well, who's going to be the owner in my legend of this crazy dog, of this massive dog? Well, the owner's got to be just as terrifying then to own this dog. So to me, like, it lines up that the dog is the impetus of this legend, and Mr. Myrtle is just, like, an unfortunate... The personality they believe Mr. Myrtle to have is kind of an unfortunate plus one to the way they believe this dog is.
First time that anybody ever got the best of old Hercules.
My last point here is, yes, Kayvon, I agree with the racial inequalities in that, you know, that there is historical precedent for what you're talking about. My only thing is, though, he said he would have beat his record if he didn't go blind. Therefore, he is saying that he was very good.
Yeah.
So it's hard for me to accept that we're going to lose what was maybe a baseball legend at that time. You know, yes, had the injury, the blindness. But again, too, coming back to the community, we're talking about the 27 Yankees here, one of the, like, pretty much the most famous roster of all time. And there's a dude in your community who loves baseball and who was on that team.
What, does he say just, he's on that team?
Yeah. I would have beat his record. I would have
No, he doesn't say he's on that team, though.
They do take that picture together.
He's in the uniform.
You knew Babe Ruth?
George?
I mean, how could this community not know about this? How they built up baseball.
I was going to say, and I'm bringing this into a theatrical analogy, because I'm starting to think, if I knew a Broadway star from 30 years ago who was it in their day, but I'm only 8 years old or I'm 10 years old, I don't know the heroes and legends, even if you're in baseball. Maybe you know Babe Ruth, you know the greats, but you don't know, you weren't even alive when this injury happened with this guy and his career never happened. You weren't even alive. And if most of the families, I think, just moved there. A lot of, you know, they talked about the kids moving into town and Smalls was the last one to move away. But then the kids all left in their various seasons after that summer where, you know, the families maybe hadn't been in town. How long have these guys been friends? Is this their third summer playing together? I don't know. Fourth summer playing together where maybe, of the baseball players in the town, just these families didn't know.
I think you just knocked it out of the park for me, which is, I agree with Markian saying that that's a pretty amazing thing to be on that team at that year. But ask a 12-year-old today who's on the 95-96 Bulls, they can all say Michael Jordan. But ask them who was the small forward. Ask them who was one of the other guards. That's impossible to know. No, those kids don't know that.
Okay, well, I can't vote in this one.
I'll get it over with. I'll just get over with it. The full-on way. Sandlot's a perfect movie.
Yeah, I'm going to jump on the fact that the legend is a way for just like there's two ways to look at it, which is like, how does the community not know about this guy? And there's a lot of great reasons from, as we said, like the fact that he never actually hit his fame per se. He got robbed from his fame by his blindness injury, combined with the potential of, combined with the racial inequality of the time, perhaps families are like, maybe we don't talk to that guy. And then the other side of it is too, like, it's a legend from a children's perspective. So you put those two together and just become so like amorphous that it's like absolutely. And the dog is huge. And the dog is huge. You put that all together and you're like, this legend makes sense for me, because we only ever see this legend from the perspective of the children too. There's no parent that ever actually says anything about Mr.
Right.
Man. So we only know that the kids think this. We don't know the community thinks this. We know the kids think this for sure. And I completely think it's a way that the kids think this.
Why don't you just knock on the door? I'd have gotten it for you.
I think that's, well said, that if from the kid's point of view, and this is the view that the story is told, that it's a way as well.
Life finds a way.
Sandlot's a way. 2 out of 3.
Sandlot's a way. It's
home
a
run.
Way. 2 out of 3.
It had been a solid victory.
Yeah.
Home run.
Yep.
If that lifeguard had a little bit of hustle in his step, could have been a 3 out of 3.
Could have been a 3 out of 3.
Always.
I'm surprised it's not a 3 out of 3.
Markin, do you want to introduce the fun-o-meter thing? And I have a little bit of a bonus part I want to add to it this time.
Sure. So we're just into the last section here called the fun-o-meter, Laura, where we're going to rate this from an adult perspective of coming back to it after so many years, rating this movie out of 100 of a score, and just giving your thoughts from an adult lens.
But I also want to add it just really quickly, and we don't have to define it too much, but I also want to hear everyone's just favorite scene.
Man, I'm at a 99 with this one. Coming back to it after so many years, it brought back so many just warm. That's how I would describe this movie, is warm. I just enjoyed it so much. I'm going to give it a 99. It was a complete joy to come back to it as an adult, and I think it's pretty perfect. Oh, my favorite scene. It's the kiss. It's Squint's kiss with the lifeguard. I remember as a kid being like, I'm going to use that.
I'll jump in. I'm like 95 out of 100, you know, like I'd almost say 100 out of 100, but nothing's perfect. But to me, like this movie, I had a smile on my face the entire time watching it. I loved it. And for me, such a weird scene. My favorite scene is when they introduce themselves for the first time and they each spit.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
So
it's
good.
One
so
shot, good. Too. It's a one yeah. shot. I realized yesterday. So it's like, can you imagine like whatever spit they had that time? Like that's the one that was used.
95 out of 100.
Really good.
I'll put my money where my mouth is. 100%. 100% on Sandlot for Fun-O-Meter. I watched it twice in the last 48 hours. Didn't lose any of its charm. I had so much fun. A testament to it. I watched it with my partner and her roommate. And it was funny. Her roommate was like, I'm not going to like this. I don't like sports movies. I don't like baseball movies. I'll leave after a couple minutes just to see it. And she watched the whole thing. She was like on the edge of her seat. They both hadn't seen the movie before. They're absolutely in love with Sandlot. It has aged so well. And my favorite scene is oddly, it's a performance actually. It's after the vacuums explode and that kid comes out all dust covered and he's like, I blame myself, really. I just, such a great delivery from that kid. It's so grounded, it's so dry.
We've been going about this all wrong. I blame myself.
I heard that for the first time yesterday. Yeah. Like, you know, as a kid, you realize you're right, the dryness. And all of the kids really have their shining moment. Some have a little bit bigger roles than others, but like all of them really do shine singularly.
And Laura, how about you?
I would have to say like 98, same thing, where it's just like, it holds up. There are a lot of movies you love as a kid that had an impact on you that you go revisit as an adult and you're like, oh, like that wasn't as good as I remember it. And this, I watched it last night for the first time in years and it was as good as I remembered it. And I was still mouthing every word and, you know, those iconic moments still stand out. The performances are good too. Like the writing is good and like the performances are good. And you're like, where did they find these kids? I'm always just in general in awe of kid actors. I have a thing. I like watching kid actors as a kid and as a grown up. And I just think that every kid in that movie is so special. And then favorite scene for me is really, really hard to choose. But I'm going to say the one that I'm going to say right now is at the end when Benny buys those shoes and he puts on the new shoes and he scales the fence and he's staring the dog in the face. Oh. I think because that was for me as a kid where I was like, oh, he's so handsome. You know, he's so dreamy. And so seeing that again was just like, oh, yeah, he's still got it. And he's 13, but that feels wrong. But yeah.
It's one of the best like gear up scenes I think I've ever seen in a movie. Like gear up scenes are so common. PF getting the
flyers,
stuff.
Yeah. The PF flyers.
Yeah.
And he's like cracking his knuckles and he's like eye and eye and then the whoosh and he runs and you're like, ah, I just love when he turns over in his shoulder and he's like, no squints. I got to do this.
Yeah, I do, Smalls. I have to do this.
And Laura, I don't think it's weird to say I was watching it and I looked to my girlfriend, Lauren, and I said, oh, God, he's so hot.
so charming for a young person
and he's nice, like I too there's like themes of generosity throughout the movie that really also touched me as a grown-up going like watching that again going like here burn that hat, hey, take my old hat and here keep that glove, I have an extra, keep it, like he doesn't even ask for it back. And then same with James Earl Jones at the end, he's like, I got a lot of cool stuff, you need it more than I do. And I just, that all really resonated with me as a grown-up, that a little kindness and generosity goes a long way, makes a difference in someone's life.
Laura, thank you so much for joining us. That wraps up our episode. It was so joyous to have you here. You radiate on screen. You radiate as a human being. I love talking to you. I love being in your presence. Thank you for coming onto this podcast.
Back at you, man. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, for thinking of me for this. I was honored to be a part of it and just so thrilled to talk baseball and Sandlot with y'all for
a pleasure
this time. Thank
like
you.
Like we said, it was so great to have someone bring Sandlot. We're just like, I've been waiting for that guest. I'm so glad it's you of all people too. I'm like, this is a fucking perfect melding of worlds here.
Thanks for joining us. That was the best.
Yay. I love it. Thanks, guys. You're so awesome.
Thank you.
So happy to be here.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the No Way podcast. No Way is produced by Markian Tarasiak, Kayvon Koshkam, and Mike Gill with the help of Speakeasy Theater and the Cinematics Creation Company. The show is edited by Kayvon Koshkam with original music by Ben Elliott. The No Way podcast is produced on the unceded lands of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. Please join us next Friday for another exciting episode of No Way, and make sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at No Way Podcast and Twitter at No Way Pod. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll catch you next time at the movies.